2,200 pages released at 8 p.m. the day before. He didn't feel like that could be met under those circumstances.
In a rare move, Senator Dan Sullivan votes against his party on the spending bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 23rd. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, cases of MOVI bacteria are being seen more and more in Alaska wildlife.
I think because it's widespread now, we've seen it from the Kenai to the Brooks Range, that does suggest that it's likely it's been around for a while.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The Alaska Senate passed a bill today intended to limit state spending, but not before Democratic senators in the minority caucus staged a protest, leaving the Senate floor. The bill says the state should limit spending on state agencies to $4.1 billion starting next year. Minority caucus senators offered 13 amendments. None of them passed. Senate President Pete Kelly ruled three of them out of order, which means senators didn't debate or vote on them. And that is what sparked the protest. Minority Leader Berta Gardner of Anchorage says Kelly was wrong that the amendments weren't relevant to the bill.
Just because the chair says something is so, and the caucus members are obligated to follow their leader, does not make it so. And Mr. Chair, with that, we protest those rulings about things not being germane.
Gardner then walked out, followed by four other Democrats. The amendments would have required the state to draw at least as much from Alaska Permanent Fund earnings for dividends as for state government spending. After the minority members walked out of the chamber, the bill passed 13-0. Bill supporter Natasha von Imhoff, a Republican senator from Anchorage, says it would set a precedent for future budgets.
This bill is an agreed-upon set of principles which this legislature and future legislators can utilize when setting an annual budget.
The bill faces a difficult path in the House. Even if it becomes law, it's not clear if it'll have an effect in the future. Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski says future lawmakers would ignore the measure. That's because the legislature would be free to set the budget at whatever level it wants.
I think it's important to be straight with Alaskans about this bill. And the truth is that Alaskans want fiscal restraint, but this statute does not change a thing.
While Democratic senators say the bill won't have a long-term effect, they said it was important to protest Kelly's ruling because it diminished their role. In the Alaska House, the leaders plan to pass their own version of the operating budget tonight. Debate began by focusing on what the PFD amount should be. As of 4:30 p.m. today, the House had not reached a conclusion. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan typically votes with the Republican leadership in the Senate, but in the wee hours of this morning, Congress passed a $1.3 trillion spending bill, and Sullivan voted no. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin explains.
Sullivan has not granted interviews in recent days, and he caught a flight soon after the vote. Spokesman Matt Shukaro says the senator voted no because he felt he didn't have enough time to review the bill.
His commitment to Alaskans is to provide an appropriate level of due diligence and attention. 2,200 pages released at 8 p.m. The day before. He didn't feel like that could be met under those circumstances.
That echoes the complaints other senators, mostly Democrats, made last year. They said they only had a few hours to read the final versions of a health care repeal bill and the Republican tax bill. Sullivan voted for both of those. Shukaro says those were different because Sullivan had a hand in crafting them.
As for health care, the senator was there negotiating. We were negotiating specific Alaska things. He was there at the table and having many conversations, and the tax bill itself as well. So I don't think those analogies hold up.
Shukaro points out Sullivan voted against a spending bill in 2015 as well, citing a lack of time to read the bill. Back then, Sullivan also knocked the legislation for adding to the national debt.
But I say to Congress, I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again.
President Trump signed the 2018 spending bill into law, but he too complained about the compressed timeline.
Nobody read it. It's only hours old. Some people don't even know what it is. $1.3 trillion.
The bill was negotiated behind closed doors for days. Once it finally emerged Wednesday night, the Senate put it on a fast track for a vote through a process called unanimous consent. If Sullivan had withheld his consent, the vote would have been delayed until sometime over the weekend. That would have derailed a lot of senators' travel plans. They are now on a two-week recess. And Shukro says Sullivan figured it wouldn't do any good.
He didn't think it was time, whether it was 24 or 48 hours. So, you know, unfortunately, as I said, the votes were tallied and the legislation was going to pass. So that's kind of where he was.
32 senators voted against the spending bill, most of them right-wing Republicans like Ted Cruz of Texas and left-wing Democrats like Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young both voted for the bill. They issued press releases praising the bill's boost for rural infrastructure, military pay, and missile defense, all things Sullivan likes to extol, too. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
There's more evidence of a bacteria potentially dangerous to some Alaska wildlife. State Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Bruce Dale says samples from doll sheep and mountain goats tested positive for the bacteria referred to as MOVI.
Mycoplasma ovipneumoniae is a bacteria that is found in caprinae, which are things like sheep and goats and muskox.
Dale says MOVI can paralyze the cilia, or hair-like structures, in the animal's airways, making them vulnerable to respiratory diseases like pneumonia that can be devastating.
Extreme morbidity and mortality. And those events have been seen in lower 48 bighorn sheep populations.
Dale emphasizes that MOVI strains vary in strength and that the animals have tested positive in Alaska, that the animals tested in Alaska were healthy. The bacteria has long been common in lower 48 wildlife and domestic goats and sheep. It's in about 4% of Alaska's domestic populations, and two samples from wild Brooks Range sheep tested positive for MOVI in 2009. Dale says the latest positives confirmed by the state this month include 13 from doll's sheep, and 5 from mountain goats.
I think because it's widespread now, we've seen it from the Kenai to the Brooks Range, that does suggest that it's likely it's been around for a while, maybe a very long time.
Dale says the new detections follow the recent year's development of better tests and more widespread surveillance.
The tests have evolved quite a lot in that time, and a veterinarian told me just this morning that the rule for disease is the more you look for it, the more you find it.
Dale says the state continues to ramp up field surveillance and monitoring and is working with a laboratory to identify the MOVI strains in Alaska. He attributes movement of the bacteria into Alaska to climate change and globalization. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kasigluk dancers look to keep their traditions of their elders alive.
Our tradition, the Eskimo dancing, not... You know, I didn't want it to just die off.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
U.S. government scientists say ice covering the Arctic Ocean reached its second lowest extent on record this winter. For most of the winter, sea ice in the Arctic was at record lows, but cold March winds helped the ice expand just beyond the low set in 2017. Scientists from National Snow and Ice Data Center said Friday Arctic sea ice peaked at 5.6 million square miles. That's about 500,000 square miles below normal. The last 4 years have seen the lowest sea ice maximums since satellite tracking began back in 1979. Arctic sea ice helps moderate global climate. Some studies connect its loss to more extreme weather further south, including winter storms like those that have smacked North America and Europe in recent weeks. The U.S. Coast Guard medevaced a man today from a fishing vessel near Unalaska. Officials say the captain of the FV St. Peter reported the 44-year-old was unconscious and unresponsive. A Dolphin helicopter crew from the Coast Guard cutter Stratton rescued the man and transported him to Unalaska emergency medical personnel for further care. At the time of the medevac, weather on the scene was 4-foot seas with 17-mile-per-hour winds. Interior Alaska is known for extreme cold in the winter, but because Fairbanks doesn't have easy access to natural gas, most people use pricey fuel oil to heat their homes, and as a result, many families turn to a cheaper local resource to bring down their heating bills, wood. But that contributes to air quality problems that have Fairbanks in trouble with federal regulators. As part of our Cost of Cold series from Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig recently visited a family that says even with the downsides, wood is still their best option.
Two kids are stamping snow outside a small Arctic entry when I walk up. One of them is getting cold feet.
I wore my house slippers outside. Again.
What are your names?
I'm Walter and she's Kalani.
Walter and Kalani are both 10 years old. Their house is a big three-story rectangle with a sloped roof. Inside, I meet the rest of the family, Jeremy Eberhardt and his wife, Ember Kalama, and their two other kids who live here, Abigail and Matthew.
This is our youngest, that's Matthew.
Say hi.
There you go.
Matthew is nonverbal autistic.
Ember moved here from Hawaii when she was in her teens, but Jeremy was born and raised in Fairbanks. He calls 20 below t-shirt weather, and he says that burning wood for fuel is about more than just saving money. The whole process of chopping, drying, and hauling it is part of his Alaskan upbringing and something he's teaching his kids.
I don't know what the kids think, but I think it's a pretty good activity. You know, it's something that you kind of hand down. You know, I did it with my parents and, my grandfather and whatnot, and I'm kind of, I guess, passing the torch, as you would say, to them.
But money is definitely part of it, too. Ember works in the plumbing industry, and Jeremy is a mechanic. They say their income varies year to year, and it would take a real bite out of their budget if they were paying for heating fuel. They did heat their home that way several years ago, and Jeremy says it cost them at least $700 a month. The price of oil has gone down a bit since then, but Jeremy says wood is still a lot cheaper. The only money they spend is on chainsaw and truck fuel, plus minor maintenance costs, less than $1,000 a year. They get the trees from their property or a homestead that belonged to Jeremy's grandfather.
I do all the chainsaw work, so I'm always cutting it or stacking it with the bobcat, moving it around, and the kids and Ember help me haul it.
Jeremy and Ember live north of town. It's not the part of the Fairbanks area where the air quality issue is the worst. Even so, Jeremy acknowledges that it's a problem. But he also says that part of what makes the situation so bad is that people are burning wet wood. He wishes more wood sellers and users would take time to properly dry the wood they burn.
We have a lot of people that sell wood in the interior that aren't taking care of it and they aren't seasoning it properly. And in the midst of the winter when it gets cold and there's a lot of people begging for firewood, these people are popping up going, oh, I got all this dry wood, and it really isn't.
I asked to see their heat setup and we all file downstairs. It's not your typical wood stove. It's what's called a forced air furnace, a big hulking thing about the size of Jeremy himself, connected to a duct which distributes the warm air throughout the house. When Jeremy opens the door, there's not the crackle you'd expect.
It's actually pretty quiet unless it's really going.
On a typical day, Jeremy says he adds wood to the furnace about 3 times. He says on the days when the temperature dips well under zero, he gets a feeling of satisfaction knowing how hard he worked to keep the house warm. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
And state air quality regulators are inviting people who live in and around Fairbanks, North Star Borough's air pollution-plagued non-attainment area to take a look at a series of draft documents outlining the problems and potential solutions. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports on what's being proposed to help clean up the area's air.
State Air Quality Division Director Denise Koch says the documents made public by her agency Thursday are drafts that, when completed later this year, will form the basis of the so-called State Implementation Plan, or SIP, that will lay out how the Fairbanks area can reduce its PM2.5 emissions.
These are the building blocks, if you will, of the SIP.
Koch says agency officials posted the documents to promote a two-way exchange of information between them and the public. She says some portions of the documents are incomplete and require information they hope area residents will help them fill in.
There are data gaps, and we're asking the public for additional information.
The documents include dozens of references to those gaps, such as how much number one and number two fuel oil is used locally, broken down into residential and non-residential use. Koch says the agency also wanted to make the documents available to inform people about how it will oversee local efforts to reduce PM2.5 emissions, to attain federal air quality standards in what's now called the serious non-attainment area.
We want complete transparency. We know that this is a very important issue to the community, and we want people to be able to look at our early thinking.
Longtime local air quality advocate Jimmy Fox says he's already reading through the documents, and he urges all other area residents to give them a look so they can appreciate the complexity of the problem and understand the measures the Air Quality Division is planning and considering.
This is the chance to kind of kick the tires on these draft documents and, you know, help the state come up with an implementation plan that we can live with.
Fox says it would behoove residents to get to know the many different strategies that'll be employed under the SIP to clean up the air in the non-attainment area, some of which are sure to raise eyebrows. They include such measures as requiring installation of emissions control technology on so-called stationary sources, such as power plants, which would boost the cost of electricity for ratepayers. Also, possible requirements on the use of ultra-low sulfur heating oil, a costlier but cleaner burning fuel.
What I'm reading here is that, you know, preliminary estimates is that switching to that to help address the problem, you know, it would cost the average household an extra $300 to $400 a year in heating oil costs.
Fox says the locals can help the state understand more about the situation here in Fairbanks and could provide information to regulators that would help them develop a better plan that would work for this area.
What makes this plan successful is really our ownership of that. And I hope that all the citizens in the borough don't shy away from this opportunity.
Fox says some portions of the documents are fairly technical and can make for some dense reading, but he says overall they should be pretty understandable to most folks. Koch says the Air Quality Division wants comments on the documents before May 23rd. They can be found on the division's website, which is accessible off the State Department of Environmental Conservation's homepage. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, So Kasigluk Can Dance. The 2018 Chamai Dance Festival was dedicated to six elders from the tundra village of Kasigluk. The elders revived Yupik dance in the village and serve as the foundation of the community's dance tradition today. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports how the community is working to never need a revival again.
It is tradition in Yupik dance for the men to sit in the back drumming and singing, and for the boys to kneel in the front dancing. Between them, the women and girls dance standing up. But during Kasigluk's second song, tradition flipped. The men handed their drums to the boys, and the boys handed their dance fans to the men. As the men knelt, the boys began singing and drumming. the next generation was now in charge.
Well, when I was growing up, there was no dancing in our schools, in our village, anything.
How old are you now?
65.
Marie Hoover was a bilingual teacher in Kasigluk in the 1980s. That's when the renaissance of Yupik dance began in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. But because the tradition had been largely erased by missionaries and BIA schools, few remembered how to do it. Fortunately, those few had started a dance group in Bethel, and Kasigluk invited those dancers to their village to teach them the tradition again. The elders in Kasigluk who learned the dances are the ones to whom Chamai 2018 is dedicated.
Kalila Slim, Nellie Slim, Wasley Berlin Sr., Wasley Nicholas, Alexei Nicholas, and Pavila Nicholas.
Gary Beaver leads the Kasigluk Community Dance Group.
We consider ourselves Kasigluk Mut Yuachtait, Kasigluk Dancers.
In fact, Beaver helped start the group. When Beaver was young, Kasigluk's only dance groups were in the schools. The six elders were the teachers. Beaver remembers refusing to sing, and one of the elders, Kalila Slim, getting in his face.
All of a sudden, he ran across the room, looked at me, and said, "You're going to teach the next generation. You better start singing."
Once Beaver graduated, there was nowhere outside the school to dance. Then, that group of elders who had taught him started dying. Within a few years in the early 2000s, all six were gone. And once again, dancing in Kasigluk stopped.
Our tradition, the Eskimo dancing, I didn't want it to just die off.
Beaver knew the elders had recorded their songs on cassette tapes. He went to the school and asked a teacher if he could borrow them.
He put them right in front of me and said, "Go, don't come back until you learn them."
It wasn't easy. The tapes were old, and friends and former classmates had to huddle over the recorder to make out some of the words.
That's what got us like click, oh yeah, and then, flashbacks and everything. Oh yeah, it did this. Remember it did something like this? And then we agreed, oh yeah.
Beaver and his friends asked the village if they could start a community dance group so they could continue dancing, so dancing could carry past graduation, so all the generations could dance together. You already know their answer.
At first, we were mostly adults, but then the youth started showing up. A couple of youth, 5 of them, 8 of them, 10 of them, 15 of them, they started showing up, and we were like, yeah, I'm so glad they're doing it.
Some nights in Kasigluk, up to 60 people show up to dance together. Ages range from infant to elder. At Chamai, the group filled the stage.
Because it falls into the theme of Chamai. Our drums awaken, our roots. Just like I said, our elders passed away. And then the next generation took over. And now our future generation is taking over. So it's better to teach them young while we can, while they're smarter, so they can have those songs in their heart.
For AK, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Vanessa Durson in Anchorage. Durson is a senior at West High and recently received a Prudential Spirit of Community Award for her volunteer service throughout rural Alaska.
I'm a tribal member of the Chippewa Cree tribe of the Rocky River Reservation in Montana, so that's a huge part of my identity. Something my mom always says to me is, "You are your ancestors' wildest dreams," and so that is really a key part of who I am, and I am so fortunate to be where I am today because I know that the people before me and my ancestors, they've overcome so many different challenges, and so I really am just the product of their efforts. I have been involved with a program called SkiKu for a while now. So SkiKu sends teams of coaches out into around 50 rural Alaskan villages with the intent of forming sustainable ski communities. But the problem is that these coaches only can go for a week. And so with that, I developed a program called Skihoo Schoolmates. I set up housing, and I formed a relationship with the local school. And so so really we were just prepared to send, so one person could just live there for a while and form the connections that they needed to make that happen. It's more than about just skiing. It's about, it's physical health and mental health and just forming greater community ties. I think skiing can do a lot of that. It's very a multifarious sport. I was raised off of my reservation, and my mom talks a lot about the systematic oppression of Indigenous people all around the world. And so that is a huge part of my upbringing. And so when I went to Hoover Bay, I did get to see that, and it kind of just put like a real tangible experience to these things that my mom tells me all the time. And like, even though it's not my culture, I just felt a lot more connected to it afterwards. Cause there was like physical, tangible, it was like a real experience about this is what life is like for people who live on their native land. This is what it's like. And so it wasn't just my mom's words anymore, it was real. Like as an Indigenous person and myself, that was probably the first time that I really realized how connected all Indigenous people are around the world. I mean, all these different Indigenous communities face a lot of the same challenges, and I mean, I know they're all unique, but success for any Indigenous culture is success for everybody, I think.
Vanessa Durson lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Anna Rose MacArthur and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Dan Bross, Tim Ellis, and Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment for the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.